Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John, and I am joined, as always, by the amazing JP. How you doing, JP?
Heyo, you know, pretty good. It was just, what, 4th of July week? I almost said 4th of July weekend, but...
Yeah, we took a week off. I don't think any of you guys are listening to many programming podcasts while you're barbecuing.
Yeah, so did you do anything cool for the 4th or for the weekend?
You know, I had an awesome 4th. I went camping two nights out in Ojai, a little town near me, near the lovely Ventura, California, but I ended up in Poison Oak, and my legs are covered in this oozing, pussy, itchy, terrible rash, and it's awful, and I wish I never went camping, and I never want to go camping again in my life. But we should move probably into code. That's one of those real-world things very much inhibiting me writing good code right now. Like, every, 4 hours, I just, go take a hot shower and scald these things.
That's why you got to go glamping. So how are you going to camp when you can't even charge your laptop? Like, what's up with that?
What's camping without Wi-Fi, right?
Yeah. Yeah, let's jump into the book. This is the second half of Chapter 6 of Pragmatic Programmer. So we have 4 tips today, and we're hitting the 50s, which means we are almost through. I think there's a total of 70 odd tips, something like that. But in any case, tip number 47 is refactor early, refactor often. Tip 48, design to test. Tip 49, test your software or your users will. And tip 50, don't use wizard code you don't understand. So that is... Those are the tips we are going to be covering today.
Yeah, awesome. This first tip, tip 47, refactor early, refactor often. The spirit of this tip is essentially don't wait to do refactoring. Don't put it off. Just start. Start as soon as you can. When you're starting to write the code, as often as you can, just always be refactoring.
Yeah, there's this really cool metaphor that... the authors talk about, which is sort of like construction versus gardening. And we had mentioned the whole gardening thing early on. I think it was one of the first 5 or so tips where it was basically like keeping the grass green, or like how do you maintain like a really nice lawn? And the moral of the story is basically constant maintenance, constant improvement. You know, it's interesting because at Open Listings, we have sort of like 2 mantras that are almost opposing, but I guess it depends on how far you push it. But 2 of our sort of like mantras are, 1, prioritize shipping over refactoring. And I think the spirit of that is more so just like, don't find if you find yourself in a refactoring like time sinkhole, don't do that. Like, always focus on shipping. But that's not to say that you should ship terrible code. And then another one of our mantras is like 1% better. So, and I think we've talked about this idea of being 1% better every time. And so the main idea of being 1% better is that essentially, you know, you leave the code base better, in a better state. So you don't obviously want to be shipping terrible, bad, repeated code.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with the whole idea of 1% better every day. You know, I forgot where that original quote comes from, but it's like, be 1% better every day and you'll be 3 times as good every year. You know, I guess it's work days, so it'd be twice as good every year. But, yeah. You know, a lot of people equate software development to construction, and the book kind of challenges that metaphor and uses gardening as a better metaphor. And this is a quote from the book, which I really liked. It says, quote, just as you might weed and rearrange a garden, rewrite, rework, and re-architect code when it needs it. Fix the root of the problem, unquote. But that doesn't have to be necessarily in total all the time. You know, gardening is pruning. It's a little bit here, a little bit there. It's every time you walk through your garden, you're snipping off those little pieces. It's that daily practice of improving over time. And, you know, I think it's the Boy Scout code too. It's like, leave nature better than you found it, or exactly as you found it, never worse than you found it. And it's really important when you're shipping features or modifying a feature, like, go ahead and just like break that really long method out into two or three methods, you know, extract some better variables, rename some things a little bit better every time you're in there. And it's amazing over time how quickly that all pays off. And I've seen that in my own projects, just going from absolute shitty code bases that haven't been touched in a while. And then, you know, every time I'm shipping a new feature, I'm reorganizing and refactoring things. And it's amazing how quick you can continue to move forward in things. And I think this idea of refactoring early is really important. It's really funny because I feel like when I write, like in Rails, there's this whole thing, you know, and I think other frameworks do, where you have a migration file where you're modifying your database. And so you're adding a new object or you're adding a column onto an object. And I find myself constantly, when creating a new object, rolling back and remigrating when I'm still in development. I'll do it like 8 times because I'll realize I don't need a column. I do need an extra column. That column is named really poorly. That object is named poorly. And it's just a weird habit that I have, but I don't think it's a bad one because it's this concept of refactoring really early. Because to me, I'd rather have a single well-written, very elegant migration into a single object written well that is targeted towards shipping. I'm not going to sit and fool with it all day long. But I would rather roll it back and rewrite the migration now, way, way early before it's even deployed in production, than having to refactor it later on. And so taking that extra time to try to be aware when you're writing code, to try to up the quality and pay attention to what you're doing.
Cool. Yeah. So basically what you're saying is that, let's say you have a user model and you only have one name column, and then shortly thereafter, while you're still in development, still really early on in the early stages of planning your app, you decide, oh crap, well actually, I don't want just a name column. I want a first name column and I want a last name column. So instead of writing a migration to, like, you know, rename the name column to first name and then add a last name, you just, you know, you sort of roll back and then just add the first name and last name column from as if it was like the get-go.
Exactly. Yep.
Cool. Cool, cool, cool. Yeah, you know, I find myself doing that very early on too, because like, I can afford to. It's not painful at all.
Yeah, so. Especially if you're writing good tests that are, you know, using good data, because it makes it less brittle in a way that you're able to just rewrite your tests to right in line when you're doing that. And we're going to talk more about designing to test a little bit later on. But let's talk a little bit more about tips for refactoring. I know the book's got some here that you called out.
Right. Okay. So Martin Fowler is, he has some tips for refactoring that the author sort of just injected right in. And I think it's because it's worth talking about. Little side note. I think Martin Fowler is the one who wrote the book Refactoring. I'm going to fact check myself real quick. Yes. Yes. So he did write the book Refactoring. And I think later this year, the second edition of it is coming out and it's in JavaScript. Anyways. So he has 3 tips within this tip. Sub-tips, if you will, meta-tips. Don't try to refactor and add functionality at the same time. Oh, that cuts me deep. Okay, 2, make sure you have good tests in place before you begin refactoring. And 3, take short, deliberate steps. And these are definitely things that I need to do a lot better in, because I'm the kind of person that says, hey, we should just refactor this whole code base. Let's do a whole nother rewrite. And, you know, sometimes there are cases where that is necessary. I'm looking at you, Expo and React Native upgrades. However, that is not the approach you should be taking. And if I was more diligent about my old code bases, I wouldn't have to have these huge, huge refactors when breaking changes are made in whatever node modules package is in my project.
Yeah, these 3 tips couldn't cut me more deeply. every single one of these, I was like laughing to myself as you were reading them, because literally about 2 weeks ago, number one, don't try to refactor and add functionality, is something that I completely did. And it was a total cluster. And it's one of those things that oftentimes when you're adding a new feature, you realize the architecture of the system is poor. And when you're at that crossroad, there's 3 options. There's either re-architect the whole system and add your feature the way that you're wanting to, or first, re-architect the system, then add the feature, or the last step would be add the feature and then re-architect the system. And I still haven't found which approach is best in those 3, and I don't know which is the right way. I tend to lean toward re-architecting the system and then shipping the new feature onto it, But oftentimes the business needs aren't there. So I think between those three choices, just never do both in the same pull request. Never do both when you're sitting down to write that code. Be intentional about what you're doing. And I think in general, when you're making changes to code, like, it can be really dangerous to just make a bunch of refactors here and there. I think it's important to sit down, refactor your models, and sit down, refactor controllers, sit down, refactor your views, because it makes sure that your scope doesn't creep too much in a refactor. But especially, don't try to ship the chunk functionality and refactors at the same time.
Yeah, so like if you really take the whole 1% to heart, I think you'll find yourself having a lot easier time following these three rules. So like at Open Listings, we're trying to have all of our methods have named parameters. So like in a method, typically we want to send a hash instead of just regular arguments, just because it makes things like a lot more explicit and easier to read, like easier to reason about. And two, it's like safer. But I'm working on like the mailer system right now. And we have a mailer that doesn't have named parameters. And I added a new mailer, so like a new method. And in my code review, it was like, oh, hey, by the way, can you make sure to add, to use named parameters? And I was like, okay, sure. And then I was like, well, I'm not just going to have only my method in this whole mailer be the only one with named parameters. So obviously I had to like go through and do all of it. But I will say, as I say this, I see you shaking your head, but it wasn't that big of a change. And I will say, because we had all the tests, it was like, you know, full integration tests and unit tests, I was able to see and make sure that when I submitted my PR, that like everything was still green. And it was like, it's really nice being able to ship with that confidence when you change, even when you just change, you know, 40 files or so, and it's just like a one liner in those files. Without tests, there'd be no way to know whether or not you can actually ship with confidence. And that's like step two, make sure you have good, or that's tip two, make sure you have good tests in place before you begin refactoring. And there's no way I would have ever been able to do that with confidence without those tests in place first.
Yeah, especially something as integral as the mailer. I thought you were going to describe your first disaster at Open Listings, but I'm glad to hear that it wasn't.
No,
but even in that case, though, your refactor was limited only to the mailer. You didn't go through the whole code base and start trying to refactor all the name parameters. Like, it is a single module of the application, or it has a reasonable scope within that refactor, which I think is important. But, you know, on that testing front, you know, a lot of you out there probably have code base with very minimal or no test coverage. And I don't know how you sleep at night. And please, please, PSA, start writing tests. And it doesn't have to be overnight that you get 80, 90% test coverage. Just write one test every time you write something. Every time you add a feature, write a test against it and write another. It's this idea of 1% better. You know, I've moved a lot of the code bases I worked in from 10% to 60, 70, 80% test coverage in just a matter of a couple months. And every time you do that, you sleep a little bit easier at night. Every time you do that. I think the last tip within the tip here is within this whole refactor early tip is take short, deliberate steps. And that's, you know, don't try to do the whole thing all at once. Bite off what you can chew. You know, even set a timer for 5 minutes in a single model file and be like, I'm going to refactor this one model for 5 minutes. And then make sure the tests are passing and ship it. Just ship it. And then just come back to it. The other thing that I'll say about that is, you know, every time you touch your code, just refactor one or two things right there and write another test and try to think through those other test cases. And it happens so quick that if you're disciplined and consistent, it just grows and grows and grows and grows. The last topic within this refactor, early refactor often I want to talk about is the book touched on real world complications. And this is a quote from the book. It says, you can't just go to your boss or client and say, this code works perfect, but I need another week to refactor it. You know, it's really hard sell when you're, especially in the freelance space, you're not an in-house developer like JP has the luxury of being. When you are billing by the hour and you're trying to convince your clients of what testing looks like, what refactoring looks like, and the pros and cons within that, you know, it's really hard to frame that in ways that clients get excited about it. But the way that I've found lately that makes it a lot more sellable is that future features and changes to your application will be cheaper to develop, will deploy with more efficiency, and I'll be more confident that we won't have any downtime. And so in a lot of ways, they're paying for the insurance of code confidence and less downtime, less potential of downtime. And they're paying now, they're investing in the quality overall of the system now so that revisions and changes in the future are less painful, especially when it talk about test coverage, just for the stability of the system overall. It is something that's really hard to do, but you have to build the trust with your client and you have to slowly let them know of those wins. And when clients are like, oh, you know, why is this so easy and cheap? You know, if there is something that's easy and cheap, blame it on the test investment that's been made, even though it's not 100% true, but it does help you deploy. So it is true. And just be like, hey, you know what? This was a little bit easier to do because of tests, or, you know, start describing how much harder it would have been if we didn't even have the minimal test coverage to try to sell further test coverage. So it's like, hey, yeah, this took me 20 hours, but it would have taken me 30 if I didn't have this little bit of test coverage. In the future, we can start getting more efficiency gains if we start investing more into testing and into refactoring. But those are just some things I've found that clients tend to start to understand, but it can be a really, really hard sell.
Yeah, totally. I am very fortunate enough because we have daily stand-ups, and it's very... It's not uncommon for someone to be like, okay, I was working on this yesterday, but after I deployed, I have a couple of failing copy bar tests, so I'm going to try to knock those out at some point today. Hopefully we ship at the end of the day. And it's like, okay, cool. So it's like, you already have the expectation, or you're not like, you're already accepting of the fact that like, oh, okay, this is actually going to take a little bit longer because some tests are failing, you know? So it's not right. Like you have the feature done, like how come we can't just ship it?
Well, and everyone in the room understands that and understands that, you know, a project scope is a moving target to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. And we'll get to the idea of like the culture surrounded by testing in a second. But on to the next one. Before we go too far into refactoring, we need to refactor this tip, our discussion of this tip. So that was tip 47. Tip 48 is design to test. And so this is the idea that you should be thinking about your testing before you write a line of code. And I mean, that's like a little extreme. So like, obviously, you can probably open up like a REPL or like have a little bit of a playground and start like, you know, prototyping ideas before you start testing, obviously. But the real theme here is basically like, don't write your business logic without already having in mind what you're going to test. And I feel like this is just something that is a mindset that as a software engineer, you eventually just grow to have, versus like, oh, I'm just going to write some code and ship some feature. I used to have like this resistance to testing because I was always aware of it when I was first learning how to program, but I'd always be like, I don't really want to write tests, or like I would make something and then I'd be like, I could test it, or I could just, you know, keep refactoring, or I could just keep shipping features, or I could keep building onto like this, you know, whatever pet project it is that I have. But now, and I think it's because of the, like the testing culture of my team, is I don't even think about whatever it is that I'm implementing or whatever bug it is I'm fixing without, you know, first looking at the test files, like what tests are touching this? How should I test this? Am I writing unit tests, integration tests? Do I have to write a copy bar test? You know, just things like that. And so basically always think about your tests alongside yeah. your code.
Yeah, absolutely. I think even in the phase of kind of whiteboarding and figuring it out, I think you're totally right that you can write a little bit of prototype code, split play in console, look at your existing objects and how you could interact with them. But I found that it's really important to think about how you're going to test a system early on and write tests extremely early on, because if you're struggling to write those tests, the design of your system is probably really inelegant. And so an elegant system is really easy to test, and a well-designed system should be easy to test. So it's totally like a design smell, if you will, if you're struggling to write tests against something, or you're straining, or like, oh, I don't want to have to test this idea after you've got it on the whiteboard. You should probably spend more time on the whiteboard and think more about how you're laying out the domain, how you're representing these objects, because if they're difficult to test, it's a total design smell. And that's why, to me, testing early is so important, not only for all of the other wins that you get from testing, but just forcing yourself to design within the constraints of testing really forces you to the simplest solution to the problems, because complex things end up with really complex tests, and then you just end up with this nightmare of testing. And so that's why I think it's really important to test, design to test. That's why I think this tip is really aptly named.
Yeah, and the cool part about testing is that it, in many ways, it really drives your code. So, you know, it can even help you if you're stuck. It can make you unstuck. For example, these mailer things I'm working on, you know, if like this condition, then I send an email to these people, or else send it to these people. And I'm already thinking in my head, like, okay, how am I going to test this? I'm going to write, you know, a unit test for the mailer, and then I'm going to write an integration test, or I'm going to write a copy bar test. If I click on this button and this button and these conditions pass, then, you know, then I should assert that this email is sent, and I should assert that this email wasn't sent, things like that. And it's like, it actually makes seemingly big problems a lot more digestible, because you have already sort of this algorithm in your head of like a step-by-step, like you have the test step-by-step, and then you have like a, and now that sort of lays out like a plan of attack for you for like actually writing the code, which is great. I love it.
Absolutely. The next tip is tip 49, test your software or your users will. And the quote from the book is, test ruthlessly, don't make your users find bugs for you. I oftentimes, when I would get bug reports or see things happen in AppSignal or in Rollbar or whatever, I would oftentimes like log in as that user and try to recreate it locally and click through until the error was replicated. And then, you know, manually kind of write the code and then manually click through and see if the bug is fixed. But I think one of the biggest things that I've learned lately is when a bug report comes in, or when an exception handler system, a tracking system like Rollbar or whatever, gets something, write the test to replicate the issue and then refactor until that's green. It's so important to exactly replicate the bug that the user is having and not clicking through. Write it in an actual test. And this is not the exact tip here, but it's a related topic of just making sure to recreate the exact bugs when you're writing that tests. And I just think overall, like, you wrote a note here, which I think is good, which is writing tests is enough. You should be running your tests frequently. You know, you mentioned CircleCI, but I think even just locally before any pull request or anytime you open things, like, you're running that whole test suite and making sure things are passing every time you're in your code base. And that whole idea of broken windows is just so true, that if you put up with one failing test, you'll put up with two, and you'll put up with 10 failing tests, and then your tests are worthless. So it's really important that you've got those all greens every time you run that test suite.
Yeah, and then you start deleting those tests because you're like, yeah, you know, is this a flaky test? Maybe. And then you just don't care. I thought this tip was interesting because it almost shows how dated this book is in a way, because it was like, it was introducing this idea of like a test harness. And this is basically basically talking about how you should have a really nice setup for things. Like, you should, for example, you should be able to run all the tests that you want. You should be able to run a single test. You should be able to analyze the output of your tests. There should be like a standardized form for like failure reporting. And then, but you know, when I think about this, and I remember reading that, and I was just thinking like, dude, Rails has many tests baked in, and there's like so many ways you can, you know, you could run a test, by a regex, or you can run a test from a single file, or you can just run all the controllers. You can run a single test with like, you know, by passing in the line number. And I was just like, wow, this is, I don't have to like set up any of that stuff. And you know, Minitest itself has like a setup and a teardown method so that you can like, make sure your tests are, you know, correctly building the right things, and, you know, you're clearing your mocks and clearing your stubs. And then in JavaScript land, we have Jest, which is like an amazing test library that does basically all of the same things. Sorry, it's not a testing library. It's a testing, what are they called? It's like a test runner. So basically what happens is you can run Jest, and it will, you know, run your tests for you. And then you can have different commands where you, you know, you only run the tests that are failing, that previously failed, or you can only run the tests that are relevant since the last commit, things like that. And it's amazing what we have in 2018 because, you know, when I first started in, I don't know, 2016, late 2015, I feel like, or maybe I just wasn't like aware of testing, but I definitely feel like testing has become a lot more robust. There's definitely a lot more tooling, especially with end-to-end tests with things like Cypress, which kind of eliminates the need for like Capybara tests in a way, depending on, depending on your opinion on that. But yeah,
it's incredible how far it's gone. And I think overall software development as a culture is really moving forward, at least here in the US. I know we have a lot of international listeners. I'd be curious to see what you guys are finding in your day to day. I know I've been working with a firm out of Brazil and they're just like, tests? Who tests? Nobody tests. And I'm just like, really? Okay, well, on this project, we're going to be testing. And I think it's interesting the different cultures and subcultures internationally. I think that's like a whole topic. But, you know, if you're in another country, we'd love to hear from you. And, you know, hop over to our website, iterationpodcast.com. If you scroll to the bottom, you see me and JP's Twitter. Feel free to tweet at us. Like, is it common to run tests? What frameworks are you in? Is it, you know, common in your country's culture of development? Because it's just interesting within, not only within frameworks, there's cultures and different ways people write things, but even within, you know, geographical regions or different languages, different libraries that are more popular. And I just think it's so interesting. But the bottom line of this is test your software or your users will. Try to think through all those use cases. Test things that are dependable. Write tests when bugs are reported. And it's just carry on that culture of testing and stability and, you know, moving quick but not breaking everything.
Yeah, and, you know, that's interesting that you mentioned it, how it is possibly cultural in terms of, you know, different regions of the world. And that's very true. Wow, I never thought of it that way. I have a little note here about the culture of testing. And I was more thinking about like a company culture because, you know, some companies are like all about it. Some companies are like, screw that. Like, why do we need to test? It's just a waste of time. Or that, or maybe they're just not even aware of the idea of testing. To them, like they have QA people that test everything. But I don't know. Wow, that's interesting.
I kind of lately I've been interested in the idea of QA. I don't really, besides myself, I don't really have QA. I rely on things like AppSignal, Rollbar, and, you know, users to report bugs outside of QA. I'm curious if Open Listings has a QA team, how you feel like the role of QA augments or supports testing from an automated standpoint. What are your thoughts on that?
We don't have a QA team. We have people that are assigned to QA for PRs, and we have design QA. So design QA is more like, oh, hey, we actually, all of our H2s are actually this CSS variable of gray, and I noticed that it's not that. Can you make sure to like have that consistency? Things
so
like that.
Like, this font weight is 500, not 600, please.
Yes, but it's not as like... it's not as like random as like the design has it, so it should be this. They're like actually very aware of like the consistency across the app.
Well,
which
and
is
it
nice.
Shows. I mean, the app and the website are absolutely gorgeous, so it definitely shows. And I think there's a place for that. So you're saying you have kind of a design QA. I don't know what you called it, but so a design quality process, but not necessarily outside of the automated tests, not necessarily a QA.
Let's say I'm shipping a feature that is like an autocomplete search or something like that. Sure. We will have people like QA that feature, just like just someone else on the engineering team or maybe our project manager will just like bang on it. And if we upload it to our QA web app, then it's like steps to QA. We'll write steps to QA on the PR, and it might be like, one, go to the feed, two, go into the search bar, three, start typing, four, make sure that it's like auto-completing or whatever.
Yeah,
and so we'll have like a step to QA, and you know, the people that are QAing are like obviously trying to like make sure it works and maybe trying to break it, you know, just to catch these edge cases. I don't know. I don't necessarily think we have someone that's like clicking a button 100 times and seeing like what happens if someone does that. We don't have like...
Right, because you could spend weeks doing that and breaking all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, you would break so much. I'm sure you would break stuff on Facebook, you know, but...
I'm sure.
I guess it just depends on like how deep you want to go. I think we... Well, our mantra is like ship. So it's like, you know, if the QA was good enough, not good enough, if it was like rock solid, but you know,
yeah. Then and I think that, you know, if you have automated tests in place with really good coverage and you have really good exception handling and you're really good about addressing those exceptions, then that's the great way to go. And I think that in a lot of ways that like manual QA is becoming really quickly a thing of the past. I think there's mm-hmm. less and less QA teams and more automated test suites, which makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if that's going to like put people out of jobs, because I used to see a lot of like QA engineers. And I'm not sure that I see that much more. I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, our final tip is tip 50. Don't use wizard code you don't understand. And the quote here is, wizards can generate reams of code. Make sure you understand all of it before you incorporate it into your project. And so this did definitely come with a caveat where the authors are like, no, we're not against wizard code. We're not saying that like you should never use wizard code.
Right.
And we definitely talked about this in a previous episode about having a level of trust. But basically it's like, don't just, you know, blindly use code and just expect it to work all the time. You should at least have some sort of idea of like what's going on behind the scenes. That's not to say that if you import a library that converts your images to PDFs, you don't have to know what that process is looking like under the hood, because obviously there's going to be some level of like trust that you place in a library.
I think also there's a big line between a wizard and a library. To me, like is really different than a supported and well-documented and highly used library. You know, I've made the mistake of calling Devise a wizard or code gen. So Devise is this gem within Rails that creates all these different views and things for authentication. And like, I've had so many different problems with Devise in the past. And I think it's interesting because now, with a deeper understanding of Rails and with software in general, I am using and liking Devise, and I think it's a great piece of software.
Oh,
and
wow. I'm really, July 9th, huh? Devise isn't bad.
It's not bad. And I have more than once taken advantage of security patches that, like, they have updated the gem, and I get security updates on things. And now that, like, as a more mature developer with, like, real platforms and real data, I worry about security and I can't always be thinking about it. So I'm really happy that there's, you know, this open source gem is being pounded on. And yeah, I have railed on Devise, I think as recently as like a few episodes ago. But, you know, because I was using it like a wizard, I didn't understand what was going on. And I was doing the antithesis of this tip by using code that I didn't understand. And I didn't know what Devise was doing under the hood. And now I'm like, oh, I understand. It's just importing these modules. Here they are. I can override these methods. And like, I have a pretty good understanding of what it's doing now. I don't understand every single component of it, but I understand it a lot more to the approach now where it's not like I'm so frustrated when trying to understand what's going on and there's just magic happening. You know, and so I think that's a perfect example of not using wizard code you don't understand. And probably before I had a better understanding of it, I probably should have rolled my own or, you know, maybe used an outside API service to accomplish some of these things that I was trying to accomplish, some of these features that I maybe didn't know how to write on my own. And that's the thing. I feel like there is this line of quick wins and wizard code that is okay to some degree. And there is technical debt that's okay to take on. But, you know, when you move past that and when you move past the hacking and you're really trying to run something and have serve real users, you need to understand what's going on. Because ultimately, if there's code running on your server, you're responsible to keep it up. And that's a lot. And if you're responsible to keep it up, you should know how it's working. And the more that you know how it's working, the more that you can, you know, get more performance out of your servers, the more that you can augment or change behavior without causing unintended side effects.
Yeah. So the way I choose to interpret this tip is that it's not saying don't use wizard code. It's saying use wizard code. That's fine. Just understand what it's doing. Excuse me. So like if you're a Rails developer, and like you run a Rails G scaffold and you like have been working with Rails for quite some time now, you know, go ahead and use it. That's fine, because like, you know, as a Rails dev, what that exactly what that's doing. It's creating these partials, and it's creating these view partials. It's creating this model. Whatever parameters you're passing to it, it's going to make those columns in the database. It's going to make these controllers. It's going to add resource routes. Like, you know exactly what it's doing and where it's putting files. And it'll even tell you if you don't know, if you're like, right, unsure. But like, and that's such a time saver, because you don't like necessarily want to be creating your, you know, your, if you're just making a quick toy app, or if you're making a prototype for something, like, you don't want to like sit there and write like, user controller inherits from application controller define index, and like, you know, you like, who wants to do that when you could obviously just be using code gen? But that's like when you know what you're doing. It's saying, you know, right, the tip isn't like, don't ever use wizard code. It's like, just understand what it's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. You want to jump into picks?
Yes, let's do it. So that wraps up chapter 6. My pick for this week is this really cool website called howtographql.com. At the time of writing these notes, I was getting really into GraphQL, and I haven't since touched it. But that being said, howtographql.com is really cool, because the GraphQL community has like put this free website together that basically is a tutorial for like all things GraphQL. So like, if you're a Ruby developer, it has like a Rails tutorial on how to implement like a GraphQL, you know, API server on top of like your Rails app. Or if you're like a Node developer, if you're a Python developer, it has like every stack imaginable, pretty much, that's like mainstream. Like, there's even Elixir, which is kind of cool. And it's really cool. It's amazing that this is like free, and then it's just like community driven. I think it's awesome. So
super, yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm checking it out here. There's like, you select front end and back end, and there's like every framework you could imagine here. And it's got, you know, those tutorials on how to rock through them. That's really cool. Thanks for sharing. My pick for this week is Jesus Castillo on YouTube. He has a YouTube channel called Ruby Guides, but it's just his like personal channel. I'll link it in the show notes. But if you start Googling anything Ruby, you've probably stumbled on one of his videos, but he does not get enough subscribers or views, because he's got, I think, a few hundred great Ruby tips, and they're all like super short. They're in between like 1 to 6 minutes. He like really picked this really strict format and sticks with it. And I have learned so many great little tips and tricks on Ruby. He keeps them up to date, and he's constantly publishing new stuff. So it's just a really easy way to always stay ahead on Ruby and gain some awesome little tips and tidbits. I've learned a ton from him. So thanks, Jesus Castillo, for your awesome videos. And you guys should check him out for sure. Just to kind of reiterate the tips for this week, we've got 47, refactor early, refactor often. 48, design to test. 49, test your software or your users will. 50, don't use wizard code you don't understand. So that's the tips for this week. That closes out chapter 6 of The Pragmatic Programmer. Join us next week for chapter 7, part 1. Thanks so much for listening, and we will see you guys next time. If you want to leave a review, we would love that. Tell someone about the podcast. If you want to learn more about the show, you can go to iterationpodcast.com. Until next time, see you guys later.
Word. We'll talk to you guys next time.